This is Eye on Education on the Agenda.
With the Royal Grammar School, Guildford, Dubai.
Hello there and welcome to the podcast for Eye on Education. We broadcast every Friday from 11am until 1pm on Dubai Eye 103.8 FM. It is our chance to put the spotlight on all the school stories hitting the headlines each week. Our focus this Friday was financial management for school children. What is the best way to teach them about money? We were joined by the people behind a new money management app for kids called Edfundo and Marilyn Pinto, the founder of KFI Global, the UAE's leading provider of financial education for teens. We also discussed some new statistics out of the Financial Times, which show that 36% of children want careers that are good for the planet. So are our schools keeping up with our children's enthusiasm for environmentalism? We discussed that with Tatiana Antonelli, who is the founder of the social enterprise group Goombook, and also with Charlotte Borghese, whose company was involved with the sustainable fit-out of Royal Grammar School Guildford, Dubai. Plus, we spoke to the head teacher of a charity school in India. Harmony House caters for street children who live in the slums surrounding the schools. And we were joined by the British Council for the United Arab Emirates, who told us all about the success of their recent Climate Connection Champions programme, which enlisted the help of 50 pupils from the UAE.
This is Eye on Education on the Agenda.
With the Royal Grammar School, Guildford, Dubai.
Right then, welcome to our special segment. It is Eye on Education. We host it every single Friday from 11 till 1. I have to say, we timed it at this stage of the week because, of course, everyone is jumping in their car at around 11:30 to go and pick the kids up from school. And so it probably captures the right audience, I'd say. And that is what we want to do. We want to make sure that everyone gets their chance to hear our summary and analysis on the top education stories of the week. Now, Andrew has joined me in the studio because we're just going to do a quick run through first of what has been making headlines. Well, good news, Andrew. Let's start with the holidays.
Absolutely. For many schools, the spring break starts today. It's going to last for two whole weeks. Fantastic. Many families, of course, planning to travel, according to the chief of Dubai Airport, Paul Griffiths. He told the Business Breakfast the airport will be busier, a lot busier, with 1.4 million passengers expected over the next two weekends. Meanwhile, when children return to school on Monday the 11th of April, Abu Dhabi schools have indicated that pupils returning for in-person learning will have to present a negative PCR test result that has been obtained within 96 hours. So still waiting on an official announcement from the KHDA here in Dubai.
How about Ramadan hours? Because, of course, that is also due to start pretty soon, isn't it?
Yes, and so far we're haven't had an official statement from any of the Emirates Education Authorities yet, but the number of school hours does normally reduce during Ramadan. Individual schools have started to send out messages to their parents in preparation, with many ending the school day at 1:30 p.m. Monday to Thursday and at midday, as usual, on Fridays.
Yes, that's what we've got. So even though Ramadan has not been announced yet, because, of course, we are waiting for the moon sighting, it is likely to start on Saturday, April the 2nd, which means that your first school day would, of course, be the 11th, because we're on two-week break.
Absolutely.
Now. Believe me, as a working mother, those dates are pretty ingrained on my heart, because I've got the kids at home for the next 2 weeks, of course. Everyone is wondering what to do with them. Well, wonderfully, it is still beautiful weather, so you can just kick them outdoors. But there's been lots of chat about camps. And then, of course, when you get the Ramadan hours and the children are finishing a little bit earlier, then you need to think about what you're going to do in the afternoons. But like I said, Ramadan is, you know, as we all know, it gets earlier each year. And this year it is falling at a beautiful time of the year weather-wise. So I think the children are going to have a really wonderful time. Lots of opportunity for family time as well if you get to finish your office day earlier. And of course, loads of offices here in the UAE will also be adopting Ramadan hours. Meanwhile, sort of on the same line, because of course we all know that time with family tends to result in increased well-being. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, which is an international organization, have issued a report on well-being in Dubai's schools this week. Now, what did it tell us?
Yep, there's really been a big spotlight placed on wellness, as you say, in Dubai schools. We've had the knowledge in and Human Development Authority's Wellness Festival. And obviously, we reported on the results of the Big Student Wellness Census a couple of weeks ago on the show. The report takes a closer look at how Dubai schools have adopted well-being and outlined the impact of initiatives and programmes rolled out by the KHDA in recent years. And they've ruled that the policies have been successful in several ways. They've helped raise awareness of the importance of well-being across the sector. And overall, they've encouraged school leaders, teachers, parents and students to better understand the concept of well-being, not only in the form of daily habits, but also as a long-term commitment for themselves and the system as a whole.
Really interesting to hear about all those wellness reports. Certainly the KHDA really, pressing it home that they want to make sure that children and teachers are happy in schools. You might remember that one of the major results out of that student and teacher census that they carried out in November last year, we got the results a couple of weeks ago. It showed that students were doing pretty well, but actually when it came to teachers, they were really struggling, particularly, the majority of the workforce are female in the schools, and apparently they said that they were really finding it difficult in a sort of post-pandemic world. So I think a lot of work is being done by the KHDA to make sure that they can support our teachers. Meanwhile, we have had a development from a university perspective, because Middlesex University Dubai have celebrated a campus extension at Dubai International Academic City. There was a very grand opening ceremony. The idea behind it, they say, is to make quality UK education more accessible in the UAE, but I suppose they would say that, which is what you'd expect. However, it does mean that they will be able to welcome 4,000 students into their facility. They're from 118 countries, and it does now have these two state-of-the-art learning centres. So if your children don't fancy going away for university, there are going to be several more opportunities right here in the UAE for tertiary education, which is very exciting. Looking further afield, the Taliban government in Afghanistan have reneged on a promise that they made to allow girls to go to high school.
Yeah, older girls in grade 6 and above were supposed to be allowed to start school again on Wednesday. That was the start of the new school year in the country. The Taliban have so far not explained the sudden decision, which was announced on the same day. The United Nations Children's Agency has told the Associated Press they were blindsided by the announcement.
Right. Moving a little bit more local and into our debate subject for this hour, because we are going to be discussing whether or not schools in the UAE, indeed schools globally, are doing enough to represent their pupils' interests in environmental issues. With young children standing to lose the most from climate change, it's not surprising that they are on the front line of efforts to prevent environmental catastrophe. But are our schools doing enough to represent their interest? That will be our conversation for the next half hour or so. We've got some fantastic guests standing by to talk to us about that. But I'd be very, very interested to hear from you if you had a view on this. Do your children feel like enough focus is placed on environmental issues at school? Do they feel that their school is green enough? Do you, turning the lights out, closing the doors so that there isn't too much air conditioning waste? Do they feel like there's enough recycling? Are they learning about how they can help the environment? A lovely message coming in from Sean here, who suggests that we should check out this amazing initiative from a head girl at one of the schools out here, climatepenpal.org. So that's something for me to look at during the break.
This is Eye on Education on the Agenda.
With the Royal Grammar School, Guildford, Dubai.
Welcome back. Georgia Tolley here. How are you doing? Right, we are in the middle of our Eye on Education segment. If you just hopped into the car after the school run, welcome back. There's a survey that's just come out, and it states that over half of expat parents say they'd like to see financial management on the school curriculum. That is according to a survey commissioned by the Royal Grammar School, Guildford, Dubai. It showed specifically that 52.4% of parents with children aged 3 to 11 wanted to see it as part of their school lessons. They were also asked what skills they might need to be future ready. And 39% of participants said money management. So clearly, educating children about finances is something that's on parents' sort of timetable. They're really, really interested in it. They think it's vital. And needless to say, there's been educational workshops running in schools in Dubai this week, coinciding with the Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development's Global Money Week, which will finish in a couple of days' time. The programme was set up by Visa and the children's money app Cashi, which is available to all school children. It explores the fundamentals of personal finance, including budgeting, saving, responsible spending, and of course, the use of credit. Alongside this, the UAE youth money management platform Edfundo also distributed bespoke learning modules plus teacher handbooks to Dubai schools to encourage building up financial literacy. More than 20 UAE schools were involved in it. Right, so to discuss the subject of financial management, because if you've got nearly half of parents wanting, well, more than half of parents wanting us to do it, wanting children to be taught about how to manage money, how do you do it? That's the million-dollar question. And joining me in the studio, which is hugely exciting because it doesn't happen as often as it should, needless to say, because of COVID-19, I am joined in the studio by two guests. Andrew Tawad, who is the co-founder of Edfundo, joins me in the studio. Hello there.
Good afternoon.
There we go. I've chosen the right mic and everything. That's very good news. Lovely to have you joining us in the studio. Obviously, your app and your guides aim to sort of plug the financial literacy gap, both home, online, and in the classroom. Also joined in the studio by Marilyn Pinto, who is describes herself as a rebel educator, which I love. But of course, yeah, founder at KFI Global, who are involved. They're basically the top UAE institution here for teaching children and teens about financial education. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Georgia.
Really lovely to have you both in person in the studio. First of all, let's start off with this new app, Andrew. Tell me a little bit about how you set up Edfundo and what its purpose is.
So we set up Edfundo initially due to the fact that we're from education and we're also parents. And we identified in exactly the same manner of all of the parents in the UAE, as you suggested earlier on, that money management and money literacy and financial literacy needs to be taught to our children to best prepare them for their financial futures. And we then did a bit of research and we found that it wasn't overly taught in schools. And essentially, we were under-providing them and under-serving them. So therefore, we came up with the solution of Edfundo.
So you've got a background in teaching, which means you've got a good sense of how best to get the message over to children. Tell me what the app sort of actually does.
So Edfundo is a money management application that comes with a prepaid debit card. So it gives them the practical tools to use in everyday life. Money is an everyday commodity. It's not going away. And children and teens need to be prepared. And essentially, the underbelly of what Edfundo is, the ethos around that and the core values that we have is all driven through education. So we really have education at the heart of what we do from the educational background and also our name, Edfundo, education first. And it's really important that they can have the opportunity to apply the skills that they're taught and what they're learning into a real life situation where it's the practical tools being Edfundo to be able to use to not just spend, but also to understand saving and where money comes from.
So my kids, as I mentioned in the sort of introduction, are 7 and 8. So we haven't quite got to the debit card stage in their life yet. I mean, maybe you'll tell me that they should have. So what's the principle with the debit card? Does a parent load it up once a month with some money? And then I guess the idea is they learn how to budget.
Absolutely. It's basically the opportunity for parents to offer allowances to their children. Now it's generally cash form and parents tend to lose how much they've given. Maybe they forget. It's now to bring everything into one ecosystem. And essentially, the parent loads the money in, whether manually or automatically, and then they can distribute that money to their children. So you can have multiple children on one account. And essentially, the child then gets oversight on how much money they have to spend. They can create saving pots, saving goals. They can do chores to earn extra allowance. And then they can spend online in store based on all the parental controls that the parent wishes to set for their child, depending upon what age and what they need and require.
Oh, awesome. So you can actually say, well, the card won't work in X shop.
Correct. Yes.
Oh, cool. That is good news. I've got a real thing against video games, for example. So that would probably be my pitch. Marilyn, now tell me, I just mentioned there that my 7 and 8 year old, we haven't got to the sort of debit card stage. We actually haven't really got to the pocket money stage, much to their disappointment. What age do you think this type of conversation should be starting?
As soon as they start saying I want would be a good time to start.
It started. I tell you, every single day I get in the car to do pickup, except for today, which is a wonderful. Thank you very much, whoever said that schools needed to finish early while I was still on the radio. I'm very grateful to it. So today I don't do pickup, but every other day I get in the car and I imagine my son's listening now. And the first thing both boys want is Pokemon cards. They want me to buy them Pokemon cards. They've just been swapping with their mate and they're terribly disappointed they don't have the latest GX. So the first thing they say is, Mommy, when can you buy me X Pokemon card?
Yeah, and it's not your kids. It's not something that's, this problem isn't unique to you or to your kids. It's something that parents all over, not just in Dubai. I mean, we tend to think that because we live in this such a consumerist society, most parents in Dubai tend to think this is a problem which is specific to our kids. But I've spoken to parents from all over the world and everybody seems to think that my kids have the biggest problem. So at least that's going to make you feel better. Secondly, the children, you know, they form their mindset, their money mindset by the age of 7. And that's something that we need to consider as well. So their money mindset, the way they think about money is actually formed by the age of 7. And there's no research to, and you know, with regard to your question about pocket money, there's no evidence to prove that kids who have pocket money are smarter with managing money than kids who don't, because that's a tactic. What we like parents to focus on is actually the strategy, like, you know, sort of zoom out and see what kind of mindset do they have about money. Do they understand where it comes from? Do they understand what their needs are, what their wants are? So it's a lot deeper than just, okay, can I just give them some pocket money and it will solve the problem? It's a tactic. Yes, but whether it's going to solve all the problems, that, you know, that there's no evidence to prove it that way either.
So you've already made me nervous because I've gone, yeah, so by 7, they've already decided what they're sort of...
But again, you know, with kids, I've taught kids from the age of 7 right up to 25. I still consider 25-year-old kids, so that should...
Don't worry, I'm wrong with that too. I think until you have children, I think you're a child, if I'm honest.
So, and I can tell you that the earlier you start with them, it's just easier. You know, it's not that that if you've crossed the 7, 8 year old and that's it, they're lost. It's just that it's a lot easier to teach younger children than it is to teach them once they're teenagers, because teenagers know everything, right? So it's a lot difficult to get through to them. But however, that being said, they're also at the most risk. So because they're the ones actually spending the money, there's a lot of unlearning for the teenagers to do. So it doesn't matter what age you are. I think the fact that you're starting that's all that matters. It's just easier to do it when they are younger.
Okay, so just after the break, we're just going to quickly slip into an ad break and a song, and then we're going to come back and I'm going to ask what it is that we should be teaching the children, because we've established that it needs to start early, horribly early, and we've established that one good way is for them to have a sort of a limited debit card, so to speak, and an app like Edfundo. But what is, you know, we need to find out what the sort of conversation underneath it is, what underpins this.
This is Eye on Education on the Agenda.
With the Royal Grammar School Guildford Dubai, passionate about creating personalised learning experiences to nurture independent and future-ready young people.
Right, we are discussing the best way to teach our children about financial management. That's after a survey commissioned by the Royal Grammar School Guildford Dubai, which showed that 52.4% of parents with children aged 3 to 11 would like to see financial management on the school curriculum. And they also, 39% of participants said that money management is one of the skills that they believe their children need to be future ready. Join me in the studio to discuss this topic is Andrew Tower, the co-founder of Edfundo. He's been with us for the last few minutes, alongside Marilyn Pinto, who is the founder of KFI Global. Thank you both for staying with me, although considering we've got you in the studio, you weren't going to be allowed to make a run for it, so let's be honest. I mean, one of the things that I hinted at before we went to the break was that we've established that there's a need for children to learn about money management. But now we need to find out what the best way in which to do that is. Now, Marilyn, you've spent over 5 years now teaching teens here in the UAE how to financially manage any money, if they get any, basically. What do you think the principles are?
Well, it's. I wish I could give you like three tips, and you know, and your child's going to be fine. You're done. Yeah, it's so much more complicated than that. And I think one of the big reasons we're not dealing with it properly is because we think there are three hot tips that I can just do. And so one of the first things to realize is that this is a deeper problem, a much bigger problem than we care to admit. And it's like an onion. Every time you think that that's the problem, there's a deeper layer which is even going to make you cry even more. So there are, you know, there's a lack of resources, there's a lack of expertise, there's a lack of budget. There's basically a lack of even acknowledging. Like, I mean, you say 52% of parents think that this is important. How about if I tell you that, you know, what is the number one skill that most parents wish that they had learned that when they were younger? It's going to be money. What's the number leading cause of, arguments, divorces, relationship breakups, family feuds? Again, it's money. What is the one thing everybody wishes they had learned? And yet, we're not teaching this in school. So if I think that if 52% is actually, probably they don't realize how important that is, or they're not thinking about it, because as parents, we know we have 100 things that we are worried about. And that may not be an immediate concern, but that does not mean that it isn't important. So I think that percentage actually would be a lot higher if we had to talk with the parents and give them the options and give them stats and tell them this is the problem. You probably have a lot higher percentage than that actually wanting their kids to study about money.
So I suppose the first step is opening the conversation. And that is why sort of websites and apps like yours really do help, like Edfundo. They really do help sort of get children access this education, because I suppose you're speaking to them in their own language, Andrew.
Absolutely. And that first initial conversation is really important. Money tends to be a taboo subject. It tends to not be talked about because of what Marilyn suggested. You know, it is uncomfortable and people do overlook the importance of it. And having that first initial conversation and being able to analyse by seeing what's been spent, what you're saving, and being able to budget in that way is really important. And just following on from what Marilyn was suggesting earlier on and looking at the deeper rooted problem, you know, if we look at health being, you know, the physical, social, and mental well-being, and I think if you really, really dive deep into that, you know, money is the root of all evil when it comes to this. So, you know, if you are not financially fit, then you're going to come into mental health problems. You're going to then lead into, you know, potentially physical problems and then social problems, because you don't have the money to be able to spend and socialise.
My goodness, you got deep really quickly. But you're right. Like, you're both right. It is at the root of everything. I suppose if I think about any of the arguments that I have with my husband, they tend to be about money. And people have different attitudes and different psychologies around it. And it's one of the things, you know, when you're entering into a relationship that you need to figure out first.
One of the most important things, because if you and your spouse or your partner are on different money mindsets completely, you're a spender, he's a saver, is obviously going to be a source of a lot of contention. And that doesn't work. So
is pocket money the way to get them started? You know, do they need to have some money first in order to start to learn how to manage it?
Like I said earlier, I think it's one of the tactics, but there are guidelines around it. And if you'd like, I can give you some guidelines around. So one of the things, I think we mentioned that earlier, is don't link it to chores, right?
No!
I know, it's
but
a
But surely
it's a
you have to link it to chores, because then they when get it
I
in their head.
Link
that
it to chores, not because, for example, like cleaning up your room or helping with dinner, that's part of being a family. You don't get paid to do that, and neither should your kids for helping out. That's part of being part of a family unit. And they need to understand that. They don't just get paid because they're cleaning up their own stuff. However, if they're doing something over and above that, maybe they're washing your car, or maybe they're cleaning up the whole house, or something where everybody gets to benefit from their, then fine. Then you link that to chores.
Okay.
But because if you link like cleaning your room to chores, your kid might just leverage that and say, well, actually, I'm fine with the room being like this. I don't need the money.
All right. I get leverage straight up. Okay. I get leverage. I get that you need to do your homework for screen time. I don't want to have any screen
time.
There
we go. So you see, if you give them the option for chores for money, then they get to leverage that. And that may not always be beneficial to what you want to happen. So keep control by saying, you know, over and above certain things then you get. But certain chores need to be done as part of you being part of this family unit. The other part would be quite clear about what they can spend on. So I noticed that the Edfundo app has certain shops that they're not allowed to spend money on. So that's a great way of using that guideline as part of the development of the app, saying, you know, you're not allowed, yes, this is your money, but think of it as training money. If you don't prove to me that you are able to do this, then unfortunately you lose. This is a privilege. It's not a right. Right? They need to understand understand that. It's not, oh, you need to give me this money every week. No, if I see that you're not spending it in a way or not using it wisely, then I have the liberty to take it away. So I think that controlling what they spend it on is another key part. Be very clear about that. Don't wait for it to happen and then retract and say, so be very clear about these are the things that you can spend on. These are the things that I, no matter whether it's your money or my money, you're not spending it on these things. So, yeah.
Yeah, so that, because that is a big thing for me as well. The children want to buy bubble gum, yeah. and I don't, that's horrible stuff. So I just don't want them to buy it, basically. Yeah. And I mean, so the next stage of once you've given them money, you've told them what they can and cannot spend it on. The next stage is saving. And that's something that Edfundo helps with as well, isn't it? And I'm intrigued about this. Do children like to save? Are they good at that delayed gratification?
I think it's a sense of, well, when you say a delayed gratification, you know, that's what we need to build into them. The wants and needs, we need to separate those. And we need to really teach them what the wants and what the needs are. And by showing them and giving them feedback upon how long the journey is going to be able to save for that larger item that they really want is important. So the gamification elements to be able to entice and engage the children into saving is a really important tool for them to take forward to be financially fit in their futures. And I think in terms of the education, you know, it's really important that we understand that everyone is different. Everyone is an individual. So the personalized learning journey that they need to go on is also really important to look at. And with every child, you know, we need to make it engaging, because if it's not engaging, then they'll drop out. So that's also another important step. And it needs to be progressive, because let's face it, the financial ecosystem changes all of the time. I mean, now we're looking at, you know, the whole cryptocurrency and NFTs for the older age categories, and that has just accelerated over the previous time, and it's important that they're educated on that space.
My goodness, I'm going to have to come, because I don't understand NFTs either. And I imagine, you know, if you're a cool 18-year-old, that's what you want to be considering, like a cool NFT for your money, not necessarily the latest Paw Patrol toy, for example, which is where we're at. Amazing discussion. We could go on for much, much longer, sadly. We've got to quickly go to the break and then move on to another segment. But what a fascinating chat we've had, and we'll have to definitely pick it up again in the future. Thank you very much indeed, Andrew Toward, co-founder of Edfundo app. Somebody has messaged here saying, can you tell us the name of it? It's Edfundo. Also, thank you very much to Marilyn Pinto, the founder of KFI Global, which is the UAE's leading provider of financial education for teens.
Thank you so much.
Thank you both.
Thank you so much.
This is Eye on Education on the Agenda.
With the Royal Grammar School, Guildford, Dubai, passionate about creating personalised learning experiences to nurture independent and future-ready young people.
Hello there and welcome back to the programme. It is time for our education special, Eye on Education. We do it every single week on a Friday from 11 till 1. And this week we are focusing on a couple of major topics. The first one is the subject of sustainability and climate change. A survey by the Financial Times newspaper has found that there is a risk of eco-anxiety and powerlessness among young people, according to the results from the data analytics company Quilt AI. About 36% of our young people want careers that are good for the planet. And in teenagers' social media conversations in places like Twitter and TikTok and Instagram, the data analytics company found that 15% are passionate activists, just 2% are climate deniers, and 1% are fatalists. Now, I guess it's unsurprising that young people are keen to put themselves in the front line of efforts to prevent global warming, when, of course, they are going to be the people who have the most to lose. Teenager Greta Thunberg has done so much for the cause, of course, starting with her vigil outside the Swedish Parliament for 3 weeks in 2018. She could hardly have predicted the scale of the global movement that she would spark. Back in September, she blasted world leaders for not doing enough. This is in a speech to the Youth for Climate Summit in Milan in Italy.
There is no planet B. There is no planet blah. Blah, blah, blah. Blah, blah, blah. Net zero by 2050. Blah, blah, blah. Net zero. Blah, blah, blah. Climate neutral. Blah, blah, blah.
That is her certainly telling world leaders precisely what she thinks of their efforts to discuss the issues in hand. Maybe more walk and less talk. So are children in the UAE typical of those analysed by the Financial Times? Do they care about climate change? We canvassed a little bit of opinion.
Hello, my name is Isa and I am in year four in Royal Grammar School, Guildford, Dubai. Climate change is really sad because it's us humans who will get affected, and yet we can still stop it by making simple changes like taking buses, or better yet, even walking. You will still get to the same place at the same time if you use simple changes like taking a bus or walking. Sometimes we talk about sustainability in my podcast that I do with my sister and my two friends called The News Kids.
Hi, my name is Mohammed and I'm a year four at the Royal Grammar School, Guildford, Dubai. To me, climate change means the increasing gaps in the ozone layer which leads to Arctic damage because of heat. I learned from experts that Dubai has many ways to prevent climate change and reduce pollution such as solar panels and wind turbines.
There's two voices from the Royal Grammar School, Guildford, Dubai. Year four students, no less. Now, my eldest is a year four student, and I'm not sure whether he would have. I've never actually asked him. That makes me realise I need to sit down and say, find out whether he cares about environmental issues or not. Now, in order to discuss this a little bit further, we spoke to Imran Akhtar. Now, he's an assistant head at RGS Guildford Dubai. He told us how sustainability is taught in his school.
So we're obviously in a really lucky and beneficial position where we have Expo. The school were provided with four trips to the Expo. And as part of the trips, we visited the sustainability pavilion, which the kids hugely enjoyed, and they really loved the innovation around it. But building up to the actual trips, we did lots of lessons based on sustainability through the Expo resource website. So we did a couple of lessons on renewable energy, protecting the coral reefs, and then the innovations around the UAE and collecting water from the air. Our kids are aware of protecting the earth and sustainability. They've spoken to me about how they've had conversations with their parents about becoming more aware of recycling, about not littering during their trips to the beach. So they have become more aware of these things personally as well. And the RGS campus itself, it's the first BREEAM-rated project and the first nearly zero energy school in the Middle East. So we're very proud of that, to be at the forefront of the new sustainable era in buildings.
Right. Now, is sustainability enough of a priority in the school campus design nowadays? Is it enough of a priority in the curriculum? To discuss this topic further, I'm joined now on the line by Tatiana Antonelli. She is the founder of the organisation Goombook. Now, they are very, very involved in encouraging sustainable living and green practices in the United Arab Emirates. Also joined on the line by Charlotte Bugazi, who is a mum of seven children and the owner and general manager of Kids Inc. Lovely to have you both on the radio. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for Good morning.
Good morning. It's fantastic to have you on the radio. Now, we're going to keep you on for at least another 20 minutes because I want to discuss this in some detail. Tatiana, I'm going to start with you because obviously as a social enterprise that encourages environmental understanding, you must work with lots of schools in the region. Is that the case?
True. We've been working with many, many schools. Schools, and it's really nice to see the evolution also that has happened within the educational system locally. 10 years ago, schools would really struggle to actually embed sustainability. It would depend on a teacher, on a professor, on the management. If there was someone in there who was really passionate about sustainability, then children would get the chance to be involved, to find an activity, go out for tree planting or beach cleanup. Today, we actually see that this is becoming something embedded in the curriculum. This is a big change. I mean, years ago, we had to convince a school to do an activity. Today, schools actually come to us and say, what can we do? And this is embedded in the local strategy of the school.
So are children calling on it? I mean, are they aware of climate change and what can be done to reduce damage to the environment? In your experience in dealing with schools?
Well, yes, they are. And it's very similar to what Greta says. They've heard a lot. They know a lot. And now it's about solutions. And I think, you know, the article talking about anxiety from children about climate change is because we talk a lot about the problem, which is good. Of course, we need to raise awareness and point out the challenges. But we don't talk enough about solutions. And I believe that programs where you have, you know, those awards or competitions in schools for new ideas, technologies and innovations, where you foster that mentality, that helps definitely youth to become part of the solution. That's what we need to really focus on.
Charlotte, as a mother of seven children, I mean, the conversations at home must be busy and buzzy. Do you feel that your children have an understanding about climate change?
Yeah, I definitely do. From the smallest to the eldest, you know, they all have an opinion and all have something to say. And definitely at school, kind of the teaching around problems and, you know, solutions are definitely, I can see the change myself. I mean, my eldest child is 22 and my youngest is 6. So I can see the progression that's happened over those years in terms of what is being taught in schools and how that's becoming really part of conversation with children. However, what I do think is that not always do the children see what is taught role model to them in actual actions and behaviours. So, you know, there's a lot of content, but then being able to put some of those things in practice, even in a school environment, is often, you know, difficult for them. So basic things like separating waste, recycling, you still don't see it across a lot of kind of schools and places where the children are. So it's difficult for them to sort of really follow through on what they're being taught and, you know, the beliefs that they're and the challenges they're seeing.
Let's definitely pinpoint that subject, because that's very, very interesting. This idea that, you know, there is this talk, or blah, 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 as Greta calls it, but not enough of sort of walking the walk.
This is Eye on Education on the Agenda.
With the Royal Grammar School, Guildford, Dubai, sister school to one of the most respected schools in the United Kingdom, now accepting applications from FS1 to Year 7.
Discussing sustainability on the programme right now. Georgia Tolley here, and I've got two fantastic guests joining me on the line. Tatiana Antonelli is the founder of the social enterprise organisation Goombook, who promote sustainable living and green practices in the UAE. Also joined by Charlotte Borghese, a mum of seven and personally the owner and general manager of Kids Inc., which helped Royal Grammar School Dubai Guildford Dubai, set up their school, helped with the fit out to ensure that it was indeed environmentally friendly. Charlotte, tell me a little bit more about that exercise. What was the remit? What was RGS concerned that its furniture, that its fit out should be environmentally friendly?
RGS had quite a bold ambition to get the BREEAM rating. And as part of that, they need to achieve certain criteria, offering them across a number of different items. When it came to the building itself, they have massive initiatives around solar power, which was mentioned by the deputy head earlier, around the ceiling. So the ceiling was actually, the ceiling of the school, the roof was actually made of a material called ETFE, which is essentially like a plastic pillow. They use that rather than glass because it weighs about 1% of glass, and it reduced massively the construction, the energy in the construction process, and obviously the transportation costs of kind of bringing glass to the UAE versus bringing this special material. So they had a lot of initiatives around how the building was being built that contributed to the BREEAM certification. Then it comes to the fit out, and actually there's a lot of different elements that go into a fit out. For example, the flooring. So the flooring was specified to be made from a natural rubber that comes from tropical rubber plants. And then we come to the furniture. So all of the furniture had to meet certain criteria, had to not only be forestry certified. So maybe many people have heard of something called FSC certification. This is whereby the wood that's used in the manufacture of furniture is brought from forests that are renewable forests. So for every tree that's chopped down in a forestry certified forest, two have to be planted, and they're kind of controlled forests. Not only was that a requirement, but actually they required something called a chain of custody, which could actually track which tree was actually used in which piece of furniture in the end in the school. And then things like fabrics to be made of recycled material, and also other substances like glues, for example, that's used in furniture, had to follow European standards. So, for example, they don't contain formaldehyde, which is carcinogenic, and certain criteria like that. So actually, in the whole furnishing of the school, you know, we had to make sure that we met all of those criteria in the way we designed and manufactured the furniture.
I mean, that really does go down to quite, you know, the minutiae there. You're thinking about the glue, for example. Is that typical in your experience of schools here in the UAE? Are they all trying to make themselves?
It's very typical in Europe because actually it's regulated. So, for example, you cannot use, there's different qualities of wood, basically wood cabinets and furniture is mainly made with MDF. That MDF is wood chippings and glue. And there's a criteria that kind of segments the different types of MDF quality. So E1, E2, E3. In Europe, only E1 MDF is allowed, actually, because it contains a minimal amount of formaldehyde that is non-carcinogenic. But actually, most materials that come out of China, and actually a lot of materials available on the market here that's used in the manufacture of furniture, actually is E2, E3 class MDF, which actually would not be allowed in Europe. Now, the reality is that a lot of schools, you know, don't care about that. More and more are, and I guess, you know, RGS are a good example. You know, they're part of a big group, Cognita, and we are seeing other big players who are taking sustainability and these kind of environmental factors more importantly. So, for example, Talim, who are a big operator here, you know, they're starting to really be serious about, OK, they don't want furniture made anywhere with any quality at any price. Actually, they want their furniture to be sustainable and ethically produced. And they understand there's kind of a cost benefit related to that.
Gosh, well, it is amazing to hear how it's changing. I have to admit, Tatiana, that when I think about sending my children to school, I definitely don't consider how environmentally friendly the building is. I don't consider how environmentally friendly the stationery is or where I buy their school uniform. I have to admit, it doesn't really enter my consciousness. But maybe I'm misrepresenting their own desires. Maybe my children, you know, age 7 and 8 now, once they get a bit older, they're going to be furious with me for not engaging with those concerns. When, of course, as we started off this piece, you know, it is going to affect, the implications are going to affect them more than me.
100%. But don't feel bad because at the end of the day, we didn't have much choice here. And I think now we're getting to a point where there are schools and there are groups that care and that they will give us the choice, right? But right now, any school in the UAE would have the same type of uniform, the same type of approach to sustainability, or maybe non-approach to sustainability. They would never, promote a school based on the furniture and the fitting of the school. They would promote the school based on the education, the curriculum, and the health of the children. And I think this is an added element that will become mainstream. And in the next few years, other moms will have the opportunity. It's not so easy. And I think it also comes to policies and regulations. We cannot be always the ones who make this research and have to take these decisions, but when it's not available, we need to rely also on higher, entities to make sure that these things happen. And hopefully, you know, organizations and entities such as the KHDA, the Ministry of Environment, together with others such as, you know, the Green Building Councils, these are things that can happen. And the municipalities here, Dubai Municipality, have strong green building regulations. So hopefully all these things we start to tie up and work together. It's just a process that takes time, and we need the support of the government. We need to work all together for these things to happen.
Now, am I typical of most parents in that I don't really think a great deal about teaching my children environmental issues, teaching them about climate change, teaching them about sustainability? Do you think most children are ahead of their parents when it comes to their interest in these subjects?
Totally. And I see this when we work with the private sector. When we have meetings, even in the leadership, the first thing they say is like, my son or my daughter is really, pushing me at home to recycle, to use less, to consume less. And somehow it changes their mindset. So they come back to the office and they think, I need to do this now with my company or to promote this within my colleagues. And definitely they are change makers and they have a huge power within their families and the society.
Really interesting to hear how we're all living with little eco warriors in our homes, and I'm sure that's for the better. Thank you so much. Really interesting conversation that we had just now. Thank you, Tatiana Antonelli, founder of Goombook, the social enterprise group you just heard there. And also thank you, Charlotte Borghese. Really appreciate your time. Charlotte runs a company that was involved in the fit out of the Royal Grammar School at Dubai. Her company is called Kids Inc. Fantastic to talk to you both. Thank you very much indeed. You probably just about got enough time to hit the school run now if you go right now. I'm very conscious.
Thank you.
I'm very conscious that most people are getting the car now to get it to head off to pick the kids up at midday. Certainly my husband's on his way.
This is Eye on Education on the Agenda.
With the Royal Grammar School Guildford Dubai, passionate about creating personalised learning experiences to nurture independent and future-ready young people.
So sticking with the subject of sustainability, the British Council in the United Arab Emirates is celebrating the completion of a programme that it designed to encourage pupils to work in their communities to create a greener, more sustainable country. The Climate Connection Champions programme, which started in October 2021 off the back of COP26, saw 50 students from across the UAE create 4 social action plans to address the challenges of climate and environment in the country. To tell me more, joining on the line now by Ada Salamanca. She is the country director for the British Council. Joining me now on Microsoft Teams. Hi, Ada, thank you for your time.
Hey, Georgia, thank you for having me in your program today.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. I pressed an odd button then, which is why I disappeared for a moment. Tell me a little bit more about this program and how it got started here in the United Arab Emirates.
Right. As the UK's cultural relations organization, the British Council has a strong legacy of building trust and understanding between countries and communities worldwide. And we use this knowledge and understanding to help the UK strengthen the partnerships and networks that it needs to promote cooperation. And in this case, in tackling one of our biggest shared developments, which is the climate crisis. The Climate Connection Champions, as we call this program, is part of a broader program that we developed in 2021 in preparation for COP26, basically to connect people, young people, giving them the understanding of the climate issues and then the skills and the voice they need to reach the communities, to talk to community leaders, other people in their communities, so that they can together move on and promote the type of change that is needed to, those little small actions that we all need at community level to make sure that the broader decisions made at the higher level by decision makers, policy makers, can actually be implemented. So
it sounds like you've got a good squad of sort of community change makers, essentially. And did you give them the projects or did they come up with them themselves?
No, the program gave them the training that allowed them to, A, understand what the main issues, climate crisis-related issues in their communities were. And we're talking about students, university students mostly. And then we also gave them the skills to understand how they could become agents of change, positive leaders. And through working collaboratively, they came with a series of key problems that they wanted to address. They included things like the use of fast fashion, for example, something that is, young people are very aware of. The use of plastic, one single-use plastic. This is something that they identified and was at the core of their concerns. And issues like, I'm just thinking of other examples. These two kind of were the most important ones for them.
Yes, and also was drinking water one of them as well? The idea of using sustainable methods to access drinking water. I mean, all four of those sound absolutely fascinating and very much, you know, the keystones of what we need to consider when we're talking about climate change. It's amazing that they managed to capture those ideas themselves after the course.
Yeah, they did. That was part of a process. It was really helping understand their position in their communities and to think from their communities, not just gathering, you know, theory and talk from other countries, but really looking at the community and understand what were the main problems in those spaces where they operate. So that's how they came up with those ideas.
So when you got chatting to these students, I mean, there's 50 of them. Were they expats or were they locals?
There is a combination. This first call was completely open. The university, the Sharjah University in the Emirates, hosted us. But we had students from other universities as well. And we had a combination of Emiratis and non-Emiratis. And it was really nice to see these blended groups, different nationalities, so committed. I mean, the ceremony, the awarding ceremony this week was really, really impressive in terms of how easy they connected and they focused on, you know, what's the space that we're sharing right now? What's the community like and how can we contribute to that positive change?
So over the last hour, we've been talking about how passionate children are about and teenagers and youth are about dealing with the issues of climate change, probably a lot more passionate than maybe their parents or other adults. Did you find that was the case in your group? Were they really, I mean, I suppose to a certain extent they were self-selecting because they'd signed up. But were they very, very passionate about you know, making a difference, basically?
They were. Part of the program looks at sustainability of the proposals. We wanted to make sure that it was not just a nice idea and a task to deliver. You know, we comply, we present you with our plans, and then that's it. We get an award. We wanted to make sure that they could really continue working on these projects towards the future. And it was amazing to see how they were really committed. They had a full clarity on the actions that they need to make sure that it was just not a one-off initiative, but how they could engage other people. They were very aware of the need to talk to the schools. They need to work with other children and help them understand really their contribution, because that's, I think, that was a kind of a common theme. It's how do we make these young people who have all this enthusiasm really take that additional step and do something about it? And that's what I found more impressive. It was really how they could see that contribution they could make in pushing a bit forward, like pushing these young people, other people to say, yes, I can do this. It's not that complicated.
Gosh, that sounds all really inspiring. Basically, anything that involves kids getting involved in dealing with climate change, it feels pretty inspiring. I've had.
It was. I can tell you. I mean, it was moving to see them presenting their words. I was expecting a very formal, you know, kind of event. And no, they prepared how they came prepared, even how they decided to dress, you know, they sharing some kind of look. It was so, I mean, having the families with them, it was so, so impressive in terms of how important this was for them.
Thank you so much for coming on the radio to speak to us. I know that you came on at quite short notice, so we really appreciate that. It's a very interesting topic and one we really wanted to cover on the show. So thank you very much indeed for joining us. That is Ada Salamanca, who is the country director for the British Council here in the United Arab Emirates.
This is Eye on Education on the Agenda.
With the Royal Grammar School, Guildford, Dubai, sister school to one of the most respected schools in the United Kingdom, now accepting applications from FS1. To year 7.
Georgia Tolley here. Welcome back. Welcome to Eye on Education. Now, this is easily one of my favourite times of the week on this programme because it is our opportunity to take a peek inside the classroom of an unusual school. So far, we've spoken to a teacher from a rural school in Zanzibar and also the headmistress of a forest school on the south coast of England, where they basically all the lessons, everything was done outside, even when it rained. Believe me, it rained a lot. lot in England. Well, this time we are crossing live to India as our teacher today is Meenakshi Khanna. She's the head of Harmony House, which is a charitable school for street children. Hi, can you hear me, Meenakshi?
Hi, how are you?
I am very well indeed. You are. I can hear you loud and clear, which is fantastic. So thank you so much for joining us both on the line and on Microsoft Teams. Tell me a little bit more about where your school is located.
First of all, I would like to thank you all for this incredible platform to spread awareness about Harmony House and our children and families. So a big thank you for that. We are located in Gurgaon in India. Just outside of Delhi, it's a part of the National Capital Region.
And are you in a rural environment or are you in a city?
We are in the city, but so we have three centers. We are in the heart of the city, and in the city itself, there are many, many slums. In fact, all over India, in all the big major cities, there are many, many pockets of slums that are there. So we are in Gurgaon, where we are located. We've got two centers in the main urban part of the colony, and we have one center in the heart of the slum, from where our children come.
Now, I know that many of the people listening will have grown up in India and will know what you mean when you describe a slum. I have only ever been to Jaipur in India, and I'm afraid I probably stayed in mostly the tourist areas. So yeah. When you describe... when you say that an area is a slum, could you describe it in a bit more detail?
So it could be varying from any size, from say about few hundred feet to about acres and acres of land filled with these small shacks, which have no concrete walls or a stable rooftop. They wouldn't have proper connection for electricity, for water. And it's like basically one family lives in a tiny room of, say, 8 feet by 8 feet, 6 feet by 6 feet, where they'll have like a single bed, and the kitchen is inside. There's a communal toilet, and each room would house, say, about a family of 6 to 8 people. How they manage is just something you need to come and see for yourself. It's indescribable.
And the children that you teach at Harmony House at your school come from those communities?
Yes.
Wow. So, I mean... what difficulties do they face in getting to school? I mean, what difficulties do they face in their lives?
See, there are a lot of challenges which we face. The parents, the families from which our children come, parents are earning like less than $3 a day, which requires to cover the rent. The slum rooms, they also, they're chargeable. They're not free, of course. So they have to pay rent for those shacks. They have to pay for their food, for their medicines, daily essentials. All under $3 a day for a family of, say, 5 to 6 to 7 people, because every family would have 3 to 4 children, maybe a grandparent or an uncle who's also dependent on the family. A lot of the parents, obviously, education is not on top of their priority list, because they simply can't afford it. Also, a lot of the children and families, these people, they're born in the house. A lot of them are not, they don't have the privilege of being born in a hospital, whether a government or a private. So they lack the paperwork to get admitted to any kind of formal organization. So there are many different kind of challenges, but to begin with, yes, just the basics, like not having an identity proof.
I mean, I can't even imagine that you're lacking that sort of fundamental right to have an official identity paper that can let you forge a path in the world. But I mean, how many children do you teach for free at your schools?
We have almost 650 students now who come from that community.
Can you describe what their school day is like? Because I imagine you provide lunch as well.
Yes, we do. So the kids are obviously very happy to be in a safe environment, and so are the parents, because it lessens their burden of, feeding the children and the other expenses which go along with that. A typical day at school starts with, they reach at the center at 9:30. They start with washing their hands and feet and everything, tidying up. Meditation, yoga, and followed by a moment of gratitude. We start with giving them a small, like a nice morning breakfast, a snack, which is then they have their academic classes, post which they have lunch. So we do give them breakfast, lunch, and an evening very, very heavy snack, because a lot of the children who go back from the center at 5 do not get any meal at home, and they need to survive till the next morning. The day, apart from academics, we have a lot of extracurricular activities. We have an IT lab. We have vocational courses for the older children for cosmetology, tailoring, their cooking classes, music, and lots more, just so that the child can experience and get exposure to more than just academics.
I mean, it just... The contrast between home life and school life just must be incredibly stark. How do you choose which children to welcome into your school?
See, it's first come, first serve basis, basically. There's no fees attached, nothing like that. The only thing is we do give priority to parents, especially to mothers who also want to work, because there are, in our society, it's quite patriarchal. So a lot of, especially in the rural and the uneducated class, so many of the women are not allowed to work, even though they want to work. And there are some fortunate ones who do want to work, but are not able to because they don't have anybody else to look after the child. So we do give priority to women who need to pick up a job to work, and they need our services more desperately. A lot of the children who come to us, so they're siblings. The older child loses on education also because they have the younger child to look after at home. But being a community center, and, you know, we have children from, say, 2 to 18 years. So both the siblings can come to us for the entire day. So the parent has that, you know, relief and satisfaction that my child is safe. The child is getting education, food, medical facilities, vocational training, all of that at the center. So,
I mean, how is the school funded?
So with God's grace, we've been lucky. We've got a lot of supporters from corporates. We have some corporate link-ups. We have partnerships with organizations and individuals. We have partnered with Homegrown Children's Eco Nursery in Dubai also, where our children are paired up with the children in the nursery, and then they exchange notes and get to know each other, and, you know, aid is sent across and stuff like that. We have the Giving Movement, which also supports us majorly, and the Global Gift Foundation. We have some big companies in India like Vatika who have been with us since the beginning years. And honestly, without all of these people and even the individual donors who help us on a daily basis, we wouldn't have been able to help these thousands and thousands of families which we are reaching out to.
This is Eye on Education on the Agenda.
With the Royal Grammar School, Guildford, Dubai, passionate about creating personalised learning experiences to nurture independent and future-ready young people.
Welcome back. So we are in the middle of our My Classroom segment, which is my favourite time of the week because it is our chance to take a little bit of a look inside the classroom of an unusual school. So far we've picked one in Zanzibar and one in a forest on the south coast of England. Joined at the moment on the line by Meenakshi, who is the Meenakshi Khanna, who is the head of Harmony House, which is a charitable organisation that runs schools for street children in India. It is linked to a nursery, a couple of nurseries here in Dubai, which are called Homegrown Nurseries. And actually, my children went to Homegrown Nursery, which is one of the reasons why I know about Harmony House, because they were both paired with children at Harmony House, and they were encouraged to, you know, exchange pictures and notes. And they learnt a lot as a consequence, I mean, actually, about the contrast in their life compared to the life of the child that they were paired with. How well does that program work? Do they feel a real link between the two schools?
Oh yes, it's amazing, especially for our children who don't have the exposure. Like, they've really not ever gone out of the area which they live. The maximum they've come to is still our centers, right? They don't have the means to, you know, sit in a car and go to a mall or to a market. So all of this is like completely new and exciting. And, you know, all of this exposure does help them. They get to learn so much, meet different people, different children, different cultures. So it's really, really amazing and important.
I mean, the schools, how long have they been running now?
Now, about almost, we're touching 12.
12 years. Oh, wow. So that means you must have had children who graduated then.
Yes. In fact, just in this year and last year is when our students have started graduating. Many of them have gone for higher education and work placements. So, yeah, it's been very exciting for us because now we are looking into their future and, you know, it's a lot of fun.
I mean, that must be amazingly encouraging because ultimately you've given them a future. And I imagine it's not the easiest thing to teach children who are facing such sort of straitened circumstances at home.
It's really very difficult, because for us, it's a battle. It's a daily battle because parents, though, of course, you know, every parent wants the best for their child, but their situation is such that a lot of the children need to go and work. They work as domestic helps, cleaning cars, stuff like that. So for us, like, if we are able to counsel and convince one family that, okay, please let us have your child here, we are going to look after the expenses. So, you know, it supplements, it helps them in a way. So just getting the child to the center and getting the parents to agree. And when a child, gives the 10th or 12th example, it's a huge, huge, huge achievement for us, because it's so difficult and it's not their fault. You know, that's unfortunately the life that they've been born into. But we do have our vocational courses, which, again, this is to help the parents realize that once they get trained with these courses and they reach the legal working age, they can pick up a more respectable, a better job. So we have this girl, Meera, who passed out from Harmony House a couple of years back. She had done the beautician course with us. She went and she picked up a trainee job in a small beauty parlor. She opened her own parlor. And now she's got her own parlor in her village where she's employed other little girls. So that's really amazing for us. It's validation for the work we do.
I can only imagine. I mean, on a day-to-day business, the strain on you must be quite full on, particularly because, of course, we've just come out of the pandemic when even the poorest of the poor were required to stay home for long periods of time during the lockdowns. What was that time like for you?
Very difficult and challenging, like everybody else, but you just have to be creative and ball is thrown at you have to figure out how you're going to tackle the situation. So we did expand our initiatives. We started our food distribution drives. What we have also been doing since we have now focusing on it more is, you know, our community help. So we employ all the assistant cooks, the cleaners, everybody is from the slum. It is the parents of the mothers of the children who come to us. So any carpentry work, any electrician work, we call the fathers, the auto rickshaw drivers, you know, gardener, they're all parents of our students. So this is how we try to help them. We give them their food packs. We know which family needs it more, who's got reduced work hours, who's got no work yet. So we try to do our best. We've got our medical clinic, which, you know, provides medical aid to families, not only our children and families, but to the entire slum that we cater to.
What is the hardest part of your job?
Keeping everybody motivated.
Yeah.
The parents mostly, because they do sometimes lose patience, but 9 out of 10 times we are able to convince them and bring them back and show them the brighter picture. It's unfortunate that their circumstances are such that you really can't, you know, blame them.
Is it quite difficult then? It sounds like it's quite difficult to get children to come every day to school, for example.
For the newer children, yes. It takes a while for the new parents, because the older ones have been with us for so many years now. But the new families who are joining us, like I said, the third center we've just opened recently. So we have like another additional 200 kids we've taken on. So these are the parents who need more, they need more counseling and more awareness of what will happen, because right now they're just focused on, you know, my child is 10, he needs to go and work and earn money. So we're trying to show them the bigger picture that if the child, you know, continues studying, gets like a 10th or 12th pass, we do some courses on the side, which gives him a brighter future. It does the vocational classes. So it's not a one day job. It's a very long process. And suddenly there'll be 10 good days and one bad day where, you know, maybe they had a bad day at work or they got, you know, fired. We don't know what happened. So then that burden adds up to their anxiety.
And the best bit of the job.
Yeah.
What's the very best bit of the job?
Oh, the best is, yeah. For that you need to come to the center. You every day, like, you see the smiles. The moment I enter the doors, the centers brighten up, the teachers brighten up, all of us. It's just them coming to the center and wanting to come happy with a smile on their faces. That's the best part.
Wow, I have to say, I'm quite a hardened journalist. It's quite hard to get me to tear up, but it's been absolutely amazing speaking to you. Meenakshi Khanna, the head of Harmony House, the charitable organisation that runs schools for street children in India. Thank you so much for your time. It's been an absolute honour to speak to you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Wow. It's going to take a lot to beat that. Next week, we will be doing our My Classroom feature again. But that was such a powerful conversation. Meenakshi Khanna does incredible work out there in India.